All right, welcome. All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the June Deed meeting. We'll start with introductions. I'm Seth Halling with AKS Engineering.
Ryan Wilson with Wilson Architects.
Eric Galima, SGA Engineering.
Mike Odrin, McKay Esposito.
Sherry Jones, Southwest Washington Contractors Association.
Megan Fletcher, Community Development.
Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
Michaela Rankin, Community Development.
Nicole Pizik, Community Development.
Noelle Lovern, BIA.
Houston Ajo, Ajo Construction.
Brent Davis, Community Development.
Online, Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Jamie Housley, Jordan Remus.
Online, Teresa Hardy, Friends of Clark County.
April 1st, Community Development.
Jennifer Reynolds, Development Engineering.
Jose Alvarez, Community Planning.
And is that everybody that was online?
This is Jackie Lane.
Counselor Young, also here today.
Well, welcome. And Justin, I see you've joined us in the room.
Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors.
Thank you. Just a reminder, Deeb, this meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted on Deeb's website. First item here is review and adoption of minutes. Are there any changes or discussion along the side of those?
No, Mr. Chair, I've reviewed and these are probably the most thorough meeting minutes that I have ever encountered in my 12 years on Deeb, so I would move to approve.
All right. Motion. Second.
Second.
All right. All those in favor, aye.
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 Next item, Megan, if you could cover the upcoming events, please.
Okay. Quick announcement. It looks like we have everybody appointed other than Andrew, and that is going to council on the 6th. So we should be hearing something by then. County Council meetings, June 6, 10 a.m. Looks like some annual reviews and an extension of a Comcast franchise agreement. June 15th at 6:30, the code amendments for our proposed housing code amendments. June 20th, annual reviews and mid-year budget supplemental work sessions. Today at 5:30, proposed housing code amendments. Planning Commission work session also today at 5:30 regarding the code amendments, and June 6th there is a technical house code forum scheduled at 1 p.m. And on June 15th we also have code changes for Title 40 at 6:30. Thank you.
Megan, was there any update on that open position? I believe the notice closed.
No update. We didn't have anyone apply.
Well, okay. So the one that expressed interest didn't submit a formal application?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So we will re-advertise for that position.
Can you remind me what that position is for? Is it a designated or general?
It's public, somebody from the public sector.
Okay, thank you.
Engineer or planner.
Engineer or planner from the public sector, yeah. Did somebody want to reach back out to him and maybe, like, remind him that, I don't know who it was that suggested, I don't remember, somebody from CRWD, right?
Yeah, Les from CRWD, he had replied to Terry's email stating that he was interested, and sounds like the application wasn't made in time, or maybe it wasn't ever submitted. So probably need to re-notice before we ask for application from him, though.
Okay. Terry on today? There he is.
Hey, yeah,
Terry, did you
want
to?
He just.
I'll reach back out to
class. Okay, cool.
Next item is member announcements. Mike?
I have a couple. I won't, since we got going at a reasonable time, I won't talk about being on time or early so that we can get going on time. Some people around here have heard that before. I will wait until some other day where it's more meaningful. A couple things, let's see. Quick question for Megan. Megan, have you looked into the Type 4 process with regards to the what we'll need to do as far as the code amendment for the shared outdoor recreation space, or is that going to be rolled into the housing? I know we've commented on that in our memo regarding the housing options draft code, but I don't know if that's actually going to be part of it or not.
That's multifamily.
That's multifamily.
So we haven't, that work group's still meeting. Oh, sorry about that. That work group's still meeting, so we don't have those in front of us. That's not part of this comment period. But
okay.
I think we suggest that we include it in that. I think we suggest that if it's not there, it's put into a separate section. If we can do it with that, that makes it a lot easier on staff. So if staff wants to include it, then it avoids us having to go through another position. But I know staff's been, I mean, it was already included once. So I think it's going to be on staff to decide if they want to include it or not.
And since we're talking about policy issues with regards to the housing options draft code,
yep,
that could certainly be included in there.
I don't see why it
couldn't. April, would you agree?
Are you saying the landscape and rec space?
Yes.
Is there any other multifamily in the housing options?
There will be. That's the work group that's commencing right now. So this is the first draft. This is the single family zone stuff. And there's a second part of the housing option study, which is more multifamily. And that is going to follow this procedure here, basically following the same process, just a little bit later.
Yeah, as long as Oliver and Jose are comfortable with that, if they're going to have multifamily, it makes sense, because that's a Type 4 process.
Yeah, and I think the main idea is, I think it's going to save staff a lot of time, including it that way, instead of doing it in a separate rule code, a one-off code plan where it has to be noticed, all that stuff. So we're trying to be as efficient as possible. So as
part of that, though, and the reason why I bring this up is that I'm currently working on a project that cannot meet the code. I know that staff, council, and other interested parties, such as the Friends of Clark County, have been interested in seeing the instead of providing a case study, which wasn't necessarily accepted by others, that I can now provide a project that cannot meet the requirements for separate landscape, 20% landscaping, and the shared outdoor recreation space in an R30 zone with maximum density. I put emphasis on that because there might be others out there that cannot do the same. And hopefully we can get this resolved before, you know, some other action takes place in order to get this resolved. I'm thinking like a lawsuit or something like that, since there's something already included in the zoning code which prevents the density goals from being met as set forth in the comprehensive plan. I'm going to keep harping on that. It's a big deal to me, but we'll just see where it goes.
Yeah, it also really more impacts more dense infill type apartments, not necessarily the apartments that are like garden style, which we do a lot.
Oh, it does right now.
It does.
Got a project right now.
Okay.
Yep. And I think Ryan might have one too.
Yeah,
I've got one.
I'm working on a project for the housing authority. It's not in a zone that's like it's not an R30 zone, so it doesn't have a minimum or maximum density. But we could get a lot more units if we didn't have that.
Okay.
Yeah, those groups are really going to be impacted, the housing authorities and anyone that's trying to hit this, you know, affordable housing, it's going to hit them hard. So we're trying to get ahead of it, and it seems like it's pretty appropriate in the multifamily housing code.
I also still think that it's going to be an uphill climb since we've already failed at it once. I'm hoping that more reasonable, cooler heads prevail as we move forward with multifamily housing.
I also want to say, I don't think it failed because they weren't considering it. I think that it, my impression was that it failed because they thought it was bigger than biannual. But just throwing that out there.
Any other member announcements?
This may be more of a question and a comment, but I know we've talked about some of the bills that were passed in the legislature this year, but there were two that I've been following pretty closely that are more related to buildings. House Bill 1042 has to do with converting existing buildings to existing commercial buildings to housing, and Senate Bill 5491 would allow buildings up to five stories with only a single exit. So I guess the question part of it is, the way those are written, they were written to allow local jurisdictions to be able to do stuff. It doesn't tell them that they have to, or it just kind of opens the door for local jurisdictions to do things. So both of them are sort of targeted towards more the building department and probably coordination with the fire marshal's office. And so I guess my question is this the right forum for those sorts of things? And then I guess the comment is that I think we should be watching those.
I would say the short answer to that is yes. And that we should consider, are these bills that have passed?
Yeah, both of them passed.
Okay. As a future agenda item, I might suggest having one of the building officials come in and visit and explain what that means to lay people like myself. Do you understand what the changes are?
Yeah. The AIA was following both of those pretty
closely. Okay, maybe it'd be kind of a tag team with you and a building official to explain what the changes are and whether or not they need to be adopted by Clark County, or whether they, if they're part of the Washington portion of the building code, then maybe it already is. Get some clarification on it at least.
It allows a variation to the building code, but it's not that it's written into the code, but it allows local jurisdictions to adopt a variation.
Okay. Is that something that the board would want to have a presentation on?
I think it makes a lot of sense, and generally, you know, the DEEB reps on this board are more development oriented and not so much on the building, and I think it's a piece that's really good to have you on and be able to bring those forward. So
hey Ryan.
Yeah.
Would this be something that we should bring up in the housing options study seminar that are the programs that we're doing right now with the multifamily?
The 5491 in particular would probably be, well, I would think it would be interesting to them. I mean, most of the housing options study is more of a zoning code work group, whereas this would modify the building code. So I guess it's a question, what's exactly how broad of a mission statement does that group have?
What's the timing on that particular housing study? Do we know?
The multifamily housing study?
I don't know if it's set up. I'm guessing it's about 6 months behind this one.
I would
probably about, you know, 7 months out.
Okay, I would say let's have a presentation and see whether or not it's germane to the housing study, or at least pass that information on, and they can do with it what they will. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
As far as other agenda items, we've struggled a little bit through email to get those agenda items. It'd be nice maybe if toward the end of our meetings that we could discuss what agenda items to put for the upcoming meeting. So maybe we can touch on that just prior to public comment if we have time. But with that, we'll move on to the item number two on the agenda, the wetland habitat biennial code update. Brent.
Good afternoon. So I don't have a lot. I just wanted to touch base on where we're at with both the critical areas ordinance update and biannual code amendments. First, with the critical areas ordinance update, we're tied to the shoreline master program amendment, and that's why the implementation has been delayed. And ecology's comment period on that closes today. And talking to community planning staff, they anticipate ecology could take up to 2 weeks to provide any comments for response. And then we would expect to get a response back to ecology within about 2 weeks. And so we're probably looking at early, mid, or late July, because once we get the final letter on the Shoreline Master Program amendments from ecology, that and the critical areas ordinance update become effective within after 14 days from receipt of that letter. So that's what we're looking at. So if you've got projects getting started and you want to get at least get vested as far as determinations for riparian habitat in particular, you should get a predetermination application in before the effective date comes up.
Would that also include currently exempt wetlands?
Yes, it would. Correct.
Okay, so just to clarify, their comment period closes today, about 2 weeks that you would hear a response, taking you guys about 2 weeks to respond. So the earliest that this could be effective would be early to mid-July. Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, if they receive no comments and we haven't had any communication from ecology as far as what they're receiving,
okay,
they could potentially act faster, but I just, you know, we don't know their time frames and what they do, but Jenna was pretty confident that it would take them 2 weeks to get us any comments for response, and then that would drive the rest of the timeline.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, with regard to biannual code updates, we are finalizing compiling the list of items that we want to bring forward. We haven't really dove into code writing yet. We are giving staff until the end of the day tomorrow to submit any additional items. And so my anticipation is that I would be coming back to you in August with the list of amendments and draft language. And we would be trying to coordinate that so you would have an opportunity to provide written comment that we could present at the first work session with council.
Do you know what the extent of those are? He's just kind of still waiting for them all to come in from staff.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really anything major at this point. A lot of corrections and clarifications. I do know I found some Scrivener's errors in the critical areas ordinance update that so we'll be bringing a couple of those forward. I believe April's been working on the public notice radius and requirements, and so that's going to be included. But yeah, other than that, well, you know, there's a few other things, but nothing that really stands out.
Brent, one question in terms of the wetlands. With that recent Supreme Court ruling regarding the jurisdictional wetlands from the CORES aspect, will that change anything in terms of how the county, it has potential to be a pretty big change, it sounded like.
nationwide, this is going to have a significant impact. In the state of Washington, it's going to effectively have very little impact for you and your clients and your constituents because of state law and the ecology's interpretation of the Water Pollution Control Act. What is going to change probably is how you interact with ecology. I don't have any idea what that's going to look like, but ecology is likely going to require more process where they would normally just be doing a Section 401 certification for the Corps, because the Corps is going to have a lot less jurisdiction. So essentially, our understanding at this point is any wetlands that don't have a direct surface connection that is relatively permanent to a flowing water body is not going to be subject to federal jurisdiction. So, you know, and I guess the other piece with that is if you get a jurisdictional determination from the Corps that says we don't have jurisdiction, you know, we're still going to have to look at it under state law and county code. So if the Corps does confirm your wetland boundaries, you know, we will still be able to accept that as part of our determination process. But I think really, you know, as far as it, the hoops that your clients have to jump through or you have to jump through in your projects, it's just going to be less interaction with the Corps, and ecology is going to probably come up with something to fill the gap.
That might not be such a bad thing.
Yeah, the Corps been taking a long time on these.
Yeah, again, that's only going to be for those wetlands that don't have that direct surface connection. And I mean, that's the understanding that we have now. EPA has not issued a response to the decision yet. So, you know, we're waiting for that to see what that means. What we do anticipate, and this happened the last time there was a change with the Waters of the U.S. rule, is we expect to see more violations, because a lot of people will take what they're hearing in the media and assume that there's no more regulation.
Any other questions for Brent? Thank you. The next item is Deeb's comments on the draft housing options code. Eric, if you want to lead that, please.
I noticed one thing on our agenda that looks like it might be off, and that's the county council meetings. Because I was just looking on my phone. Yeah, I was looking on my phone to make sure I had it on there. And when I looked at it, I had a conflict because the Planning Commission hearing is the same date for the same thing. So I think what's under the council meeting agenda is actually the Planning Commission agendas. Yeah, yeah. So there's one on June 1st and one on June 15th. And those coincide with the Planning Commission hearings. So just a quick correction. We can just strike those because we already have them in the other sections too for Planning Commission. So, although, what is June? Okay, yeah, no, it's on. They're both on here for Planning Commission. So we can strike those from the minutes. And
so which one?
They were this one here,
okay.
The June 15th and the June 1st from the council meetings. Those are actually Planning Commission. I don't think the council ones are scheduled yet.
Oh.
They're the same. We have them in both places.
Yep, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
So I just noticed it when I was trying to enter in my phone, because whenever I see these, I try to put them in right away if it's something I want to attend.
Yep.
So
thank you.
So anyway, everyone should have kind of at the back of the packet our draft comments. And this is as complex. There's a lot of items. So I tried to get feedback from everybody in advance, and then I circulated it out. And I kind of put together a draft with everyone's comments that we had from the last one. So I started with our initial comments. I referenced the code and the draft code overview by Jet Planning and the draft code, and then tried to categorize them as well by the actual code sections and provide comments on the things that we talked about in our last meeting, the stuff that we brought up in our previous meetings before they started, and then everything I received by email from a few participants. So hopefully that helps us go a little bit smoother, because I don't know how we'd be compiling it in this meeting on the fly, especially when Planning Commission has a hearing tonight at a work session tonight. But it sure would be nice to get them this in advance and get it in their packet, so when they look at it, they have this in front of them. So they won't have a lot of time to review it, but this is just a work session. Ideally, it'd be great to present to the Planning Commission. We used to do that, but I know I can't do it tonight, but and it's a little late notice, but it, maybe at least get the memo to them. So I guess at this point, I would open up the floor to any comments on this and things we want to add to it. Like I said, I tried to comment on the stuff that was sent over. Everything underlined are new things that were added based on the email comments, and then the other stuff is from the original draft. So
I think we could also open this up for any comments from the audience too.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Eric, I guess I'd noted a few items on here. One of them with, you know, I understand our comment regarding the 3 acre maximum lot size or parcel size, but that 3 acres removes like your right of way tracks or private streets and also critical areas. Well, critical areas includes, you know, wetland habitat, but also geohazard and CARA, which basically the entire UGA is CARA area. So how is that being applied, or is that, you know, per code, per the definition of critical areas, that would be subtracted from your?
So what you would suggest, Seth, is then it would be a, even though we don't necessarily agree with the 3 acre minimum per se, that should be a 3 acre net of any.
But that makes it worse.
Oh, it does make it worse.
It makes it worse.
Yeah.
Well,
it,
essentially, if you're removing, even if you have a 3 acre parcel and you remove critical areas from it, your entire site is under CARA. So do you then have a site?
If it's a CARA 2, that's not a concern.
It per code, it technically
per
is critical.
It's technically
so.
A critical area, but I mean, it's the CARA 1 areas that, you know, the wellhead recharge areas.
Right.
That, or protection areas that we need to be concerned about there, but CARA 2, I don't really think that's the thing. I think that you do bring up a good point with regards to how one addresses critical areas with regards to that. And that might, what section was that?
40.260.072. I'm looking at it right now.
Compact
lots. Yeah. So eligibility, the parcels 3 acres or smaller,
right?
Parcels 3 acres or smaller in area, excluding any critical areas. I just think we should just get rid of the whole thing. And actually, it's a maximum, not a minimum. So that we need to correct.
No, it was set up to be a maximum, Eric, because it's an incentive. It's incentive to try and develop smaller parcels.
Permitted in parcels.
So it's sort of like the old infill ordinance.
Yeah.
The whole incentive
right.
there with
I think
this
we're good
whole
with
thing.
That.
It's not a maximum. It's like the old infill.
Well, yes, it is. And I guess I remember a different comment, because originally we were talking about it. The parcel had to be 3 acres or larger, and it actually says 3 acres or smaller. So our comment on the 3 acres is not necessarily correct. We have to correct that. Because what I was thinking is I've seen this more applicability on smaller sites, which is what it's meant for. So still, even the 3 acre, I mean, I don't know why you couldn't do a compact lot development on something over 3 acres, but.
Does that then get into one of the other types of housing options then?
That's a great question, Mike, and I think it does, because there's enough different density and enough different actions that you can do. Like, you can put in townhouses on in the bigger lot sizes now.
So I think the main concern we had, and we have to correct the minimum to maximum size, but this was kind of touted as something that if you they changed the cottage ordinance to be a lot more restrictive, because a lot of the cottages were actually being built more like this compact lot development, because that's what was cost effective. And they ended up being more compact lots because they're also fee simple, where cottages aren't. So if we're going to say that you can do cottages on sites that size, why couldn't you do compact lots on sites over 3 acres? So, and again, yeah, like you said, if you do look at taking out critical areas, things like that, that is in here. But I think we get rid of it altogether. I don't think there should be an area threshold.
And I guess another thought was, if there is some threshold needed, that potentially there could be some incentive, like being able to remove like open space and amenity space from that. So if you know, that way you're able to, if you're, say the limit is 3 acres, but you have 3.5 and you set aside 1/2 acre for open space and amenities, it could still allow somebody to develop it and utilize that and still make a nice, you know, community. But
right.
It's kind of tough to incorporate that into the way our recommendation is written, in terms of, you know, we're recommending that we remove this threshold completely.
Yeah. So how do we want to handle it? I think we still suggest striking it. But
well,
if they don't strike it, should we also have them remove any open space? Is that how, or a recreation area?
Yeah, it would have to be net so that we would meet the maximum, if that's indeed the case. I get, and I don't know if who else is on here or anybody from that helped develop this, but what was the reasoning behind the 3 acre maximum size? Is there anybody on that could answer that?
I can answer that.
Cool.
So yeah, I said in all these meetings, in fact, I'm on the multifamily also, but then it basically was a takeoff of the old infill ordinance, which was 2.5 acres as a maximum size. And we just looked at trying to make it a little bit bigger, and then how do we make incentives to make, you know, the development of small parcels more efficient and more beneficial to the middle, missing middle.
Okay. So then let me just kind of clarify what I'm going to do to this comment when we make the revisions. We're going to first recommend that they strike the area completely, but if they don't, then we would recommend they also subtract out things like open space and stormwater tracks and anything that's not buildable area. So does that work for everybody?
I'd like to go back to Dan, who was part of this. Dan, was there any discussion about not having a limitation on the size? Or
no, there was no, I mean, there was no discussion about how, there was discussion about how big should we make it, because one of the big benefits is Section D. It says compact lot developments may include single-family detached dwellings up to 200%. So if you allow that on all developments, you could end up having, you know, basically you've opened up all developments to be in double density.
All right. Yeah, that makes sense. That would run contrary to the comp plan. can't do that. All right, thanks for that explanation, Dan. That makes sense. And the reason why I wanted to ask that is I don't want to arbitrarily be proposing something unless we have the full understanding as to why something is what it is. I mean, if you look at any numerical standard in any code, there's a reason for it. And if you understand the reason, then it makes sense. Sometimes the reason doesn't necessarily make sense, but it made sense at a certain moment in time. And at this moment in time, that does make sense. Thanks, Dan.
Do we want to take the 3 acre out, or do we still want to suggest it?
I say that we get a clarification that if there's no allowance for removing critical areas, stormwater tracks, rights of way, things of that nature, those typical things that would be removed from a density calculation in order to get your minimum density, unless that is already included in there with regards to density calculation, meaning do we have to have that in there if if when you're calculating density in these compact lot developments, it follows the minimum and maximum density calculations in code. I don't think it matters. I really don't think it matters at the end of the day, because in order to get minimum density, you can remove all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it, Mike, the code is, as proposed, says that the parcel size shall be 3 acres or smaller in area, excluding any critical areas, public right-of-ways, private road easements, or street tracks. So the only thing that hasn't been covered is your stormwater.
And open space. So if you do an open space tract or a park, or you set something aside by choice, you get penalized.
Sorry, Dan, I don't have that code with me, so thank you for pointing out the obvious.
Yep. Yeah, so that's in here.
Right, so private road easements or street tracks. I would just, I would add stormwater facilities.
Yeah, and open space.
And open space.
Okay.
Yeah, let's make it simple.
So I'll change the comment, and I'll take out our objection to the size threshold then, if everyone's okay with that. I'd still rather see it apply on all of them, but I'll go with the majority. So
everybody online, are you Dan, Jamie, Terry, you okay with that? Just adding in the ability to remove stormwater tracks and open space from this?
Yes.
From the three lot maximum. Go ahead, Terry. Yeah, he's good.
Okay. The only thing I have that may be a problem is that they made the cottage code a lot more strict, and it doesn't have a size limitation, where now you might be in a position, if you have a parcel over 3 acres, net after all the subtractions, where you could do a cottage, but you can't do a cottage anymore because they changed it so much, or it's not cost effective, or there's no market for it. So that's the limitation, is that this is kind of sold as a cottage code replacement, but it's not a cottage code replacement because it has that size limitation.
I think, Eric, when I looked at all the different proposals, is that we're going to go back to more and more townhouses just because of the way that the cottage restrictions that you talked about versus the, having the ability to do townhouses going forward.
Yeah, exactly. So that would fall down under that compact lot developments. However, if your site is over 3 acres, you're out of luck.
No, you can still do townhouses over 3 acres.
Well, not in those zones.
Yes, you can.
Not for the lot sizes.
Yeah, they're proposing that you could do townhouses all the way up to, I believe, R110.
Yeah. The only difference is the dimensional standards.
As you get larger and larger zoning, your minimum lot size goes from 2,000 square feet. I believe it goes up to 2,500 or 3,000. Maybe it's R. So I can look at it if you guys are interested in that.
Yeah.
Okay.
We already looked at that. I don't think we had any issues with it.
Okay. Sounds good.
The one thing that I had, you know, when we were going through this, when I was going through this on the housing option study, was to make a recommendation that, like, in the code right now for multifamily says that the most restrictive interpretation shall be taken by staff. There's a ton of changes. I think that we need to make a recommendation that the least restrictive interpretation should be what the staff is directed to do going forward.
I think that's in a separate section of code. I don't know as if we can include it in just this one section from a housing standpoint. I think that's April, isn't that correct that the planning director's interpretation is most restrictive? Is that in a different section, or is that at the beginning of every single code section? Do you remember?
That the more restrictive wins, basically?
Yeah.
That's all of Title 40. I think. I actually said that more confident than I feel.
I think
right
it is, too.
That probably isn't for this, but it's more of a biannual or a separate code section.
I think that's under a totally different code section interpretation needs to be made to the most restrictive. And I think that's separate from just this one single family code section.
I thought that interpreted as more using the more restrictive was tied to state law or RCW.
And it might be. That wouldn't surprise me.
Oh yeah, it's total. It's under authority. It's total.
Yeah, there you go.
It's total Title 40.
That's all Title 40. Okay. Yeah, it would be nice to slip that in there, wouldn't it, Dan?
I think there's going to be a lot of interpretation and a lot of different confusion, and this is going to make it open
for. It'll make April's job even more fun.
It's going to be a problem sorting all through this. There's going to be a lot of changes. On top of it right now is going to solve a lot of issues, but I think that as we try and push in these missing middle and try and get creative around how we do it, it's going to have some real interpretation issues.
Right.
And Eric, one thing just to point out with regard to that 3 acres, the PUD code is also reduced down to the 3 acres. So I'm not sure if part of that was also the overlap.
That makes
sense. Okay. That does make a little more sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you don't have the same design standards, but you can propose your own with the PUD.
Yeah.
You just don't get the density necessarily. Okay. So I'm okay eliminating the 3 acre then and the size limitation and just recommend they add open space and storm.
I do think that section, though, regarding design standards and stuff needs to stay in there.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the only change. So that design standard thing, and I just want to stress this a lot, and I brought these plans out because this plan right here, these two, they're not bad-looking plans. They're things that you see all over the county, and this just happens to be Manor's version of it because I had it in my file and it was available. But when you look at these, and I don't know if you guys probably can't see them on the camera here, but it's a standard thing you see out in Falcon's Rest, Sifton Furs. There's a lot of these built all over the county. It's one of the most affordable products that is hitting the missing middle market section. It's one of the only ones out there. With this code right now, we're eliminating one of the best, most efficient plans just because somebody, by applying design standards, which is really personal choice. Personal choice is going to be driven by the market. There's a reason why builders are building these. They're building them because this is what the market segment can afford. And this is an efficient, cost-effective product to build. So when you actually start eliminating and making the garage smaller, one, you don't have as much market demand for it. And two, you sometimes actually increase the cost because you have to, you're still driven by the upper floor and providing 3 bedrooms, 2.5 baths for an average family. That controls the size of the unit below. Now you have a gap below in size and you end up still putting the same space in the home and you have more expensive space to build. So you end up having to build a bigger family room. You put a dining room in instead of the extra garage. And the garage is the least expensive. You don't have to heat it. You don't have to change all your appliances. When you make a smaller home, you need more storage. All of these things, this is why it's built, because the market demands it. And in this code section, all through this, we've eliminated probably the best tool we have right now. So I really want to stress that. And I don't know how to get that across, but we need to strike those design standards.
Yeah.
And this is just one example. But I can tell you, we do a lot of these. I suggest it because this is hitting right where the income level is for your average first-time home buyer.
My experience with design standards has been the aesthetic, and you're right, it's objective. It's not objective. It's an aesthetic that is you're giving up something for something else. You're giving up a perceptive better look in this instance, affordability, potentially. What I've also found is that you can't have both. You can't have more affordable anything, houses, commercial, anything like that, and have design standards. Secondly, the people who are building these houses, they have to have some kind of aesthetic, some kind of attraction to the product for people to even consider buying them. They're not building crap. They're not building, just a two-story block. there's something to it. So we're actually trying to regulate something that doesn't need to be regulated in this instance, and that those are the design standards. You actually are taking away the ability to provide a product by saying you have to follow these regulations, which ultimately end up running contrary to everything that we're trying to do here. So I would agree with what you yep. said.
So I don't know how to stress that even more. I think that's going to come out in our testimony, and I think we need a builder that's going to testify at those at the hearing, just really stressing, maybe just hitting this one topic. And I also would like to have a little more time to work with the board instead of the three-minute public comment. Like I've said before, we're not the public. We're their advisors. If our advising is 3 minutes, and we've spent how many hours and hours of time working on this and reading through it and providing comments, mm-hmm. and it's useless because we only have 3 minutes as an advisory board to them to talk to them, mm-hmm. that doesn't work. That's not where we're meant to be. So we should have like a staff presentation. We should probably have a planning commission. They should have the opportunity. And then the Deeb should have an opportunity. And then it's, you know, general public. And there's enough people. I mean, what we could also do, if they do stick with that, is come up with each one of us hit a certain section.
There you go.
But yeah. you really shouldn't have to, because not everyone in the room is an expert on all those items.
And, you're right.
So.
And just like anyone in the public, they can provide written testimony, which we do. We just reiterate what we're trying to get across and provide any further clarification based on our written testimony at the work sessions and the hearings.
The difference is we have to be able to have a back and forth. So not only do we testify, but the staff or the council should have the opportunity to ask us questions. I don't know how many hearings I've been at when they ask the question, I'm like, I have the answer to that. And nobody else knew. And staff didn't know. I'm like, I have the answer. I want to talk. I know why this is done this way. I was, you know, I've been working on this for over 20 years.
We saw that just today in our comments before, you know, going to Dan and saying, hey, Dan, why is it this way?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep, exactly.
He had the answer.
Yep. So I think the design centers is really the biggest piece of this.
I think so.
And I want to make sure too, and I kind of started that we agree with almost all these, and it is a step in the right direction. The other challenge is finding a way to build affordably. And I was at a seminar not long ago, and I took the line, you can't build affordable housing if you can't build affordably. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the cost right now that goes into a home, before you even put a shovel in the ground, you've spent almost $150,000 on process, on permits, on, you know, all of the stuff necessary to get that project ready to build.
That's the low end, sir.
Energy, yeah, I would say at least. I mean, I have figures that break all that stuff out.
You're low end.
That's been promoted. So 150 before you even put a shovel on the ground. Yeah. And that's plus a lot cost. So if you're buying a lot now for $200,000 and you have 150 before you even start, you've spent $350,000 before you've even put a shovel on the ground. How do you make an affordable house for that? You can't even hit that market segment. This is and when you look at, is it 1220? There's a bill that basically says you have to hit your income bracket. Well, for the income bracket that we have to provide probably 30% of the houses for, it's impossible to build because you can't even buy a lot and you can't get through the permitting process for that amount. So you're not going to be able to hit that. The best tool we have is we have to use more than just these standards and these codes. We need to make sure that we can reduce the cost of building. We need to find ways to reduce some of the regulation, maybe tier some of the impact fees, things like that, because we're not going to get there. The other thing we can do is provide more inventory, and it is. It's the most economic principle. It's right up there with, like, you know, for principles, it's almost like gravity, or that the earth is flat, you know, or the earth is round. Supply and demand is the most fundamental economic principle. And saying that increasing the supply will not lower the cost, it can only do it so much because of the regulation cost. But what it does do is it opens up existing homes and it allows them to become affordable. So when you provide opportunities for a move-up buyer to move out of their, you know, house they bought for $400,000 into an $800,000 home, theirs becomes affordable. If we don't provide that product for a move-up buyer, which we're probably not going to do in this comp plan cycle, there's going to be a limited stock of move-up houses, which ends up driving the lower priced homes even higher. So there's all these cause and effects, and it's not as simple as just a code change. And I put that at the end in a lot fewer words. And kind of built off some of the stuff that Houston provided.
I do have another comment.
Yep.
Segue into what you have, and it's with the PUDs. I didn't give comment on it, but I just grossly overlooked it. If we're truly looking at affordability and we're looking to put parks in neighborhoods, I think park impact fees should be waived in PUDs because you are already mitigating for your on-site impact, your impact of your development on-site, and collecting park impacts on top of it is a double dip. That's why a lot of jurisdictions, if you do a PUD, waive your park impact fees. Clark County does not. And if we're looking for a meaningful impact for affordability, because that's a measurable number, and it will potentially drive more parks inside the neighborhood, that would be more than likely managed by an HOA or maintained by an HOA, so it's not hitting the county for maintenance, which seems to be an issue. It could be a pretty good addition to this code section.
That is the lowest hanging, best thing that has been stated, and we brought this up 8 years ago, and it's gone nowhere.
I've brought it up repeatedly, too, and it's gone nowhere, and I've tried to do
and
it.
And I don't know why. It makes
sense. Yeah, so I have a question, and then I have a comment. Question is PUD. What does that stand for?
Planned unit development.
Thank you.
Yep.
And then the follow-up is more of a statement because I come from a neighborhood that did it wrong. So not that I'm trying to, you know, say that we shouldn't change it. The cost to the community was about $35,000 and climbing to fix what was done incorrectly by the developer because it was not managed by the county and became the responsibility of the homeowners at transition. So I caution from personal experience that while it is great for the cost of development, we have to make sure that if that's the route we go, we're offering solutions to make sure that it's done appropriately.
So I think the Wakiowa statutes within the state have fixed some of those concerns in the past with the amount of information disclosure studies, reserve funds, and the developer actually has to fund lots once they start taking dues. You know, you're going from CCNR packages that used to be, you know, 10 pages. Now they're over 200 pages full of documents. You have to have audited financials. It's a pretty hefty deal. There's a reason.
I want to clarify, my neighborhood started development in 2018.
Okay, I think that was prior to the Wakiowa, which came in, I believe, in 2019 or 20. This is in July of whatever year it was. So it's a relatively new. Yeah, just missed the boat. They're essentially, HOAs are treated like condo associations in the state of Washington now.
But what I will say that I, from my perspective, I'm not a developer and a planner, right? But talking to our membership regularly, they talk about the regulations and the cost. And examples are given to me day in and day out of one example that was shared with an apartment complex is they were told that it needed to be airtight because the code says that it needs to be airtight and you got to keep it. So then all of a sudden we learn the health impacts of it being too tight. So rather than adjusting the code, it then becomes let's put a band-aid on it and now let's add this other thing that is proper ventilation. And those are so I like where you're going with your comment, and I'm totally on board. And so I don't know what code specifically those things are and how Deeb's role is to diving in on those to say, hey, we can make a building less, you know, more healthy, but without the extra cost of this code and this code that we have to follow. And I don't know what that looks like. I don't have an answer.
The energy code.
The tightness has been an energy code that we've been dealing with for decades now. So they'll make something up at the state, and every builder is going to say, no, you can't do that. You're going to rot a house. And they're like, nope, you got to do it. And, you know,
and
they
rot.
Pass it. People will build a house, and it'll rot. And they're like, oh, well, actually, now you got to change it to this, you know, 3 years down.
So I guess my question is what codes locally do we have the ability to influence regulation? And if you tell me nothing, that's fine. That's why we just recently hired a lobbyist, because we're trying to attack things like the energy code. But I'm just curious if there's codes locally that we can dive into that kind of, that we're seeing some of those things happen that we can talk more about.
Some
Some are passed on by the state and they implemented. You look at like the habitat ordinance and the stormwater ordinance. I can give you a list that's so long of stuff that the state has passed down that either doesn't work or it has unintended consequences and we're stuck dealing with it. And we try to, as a board, we try to find ways to manage it. But there's a very, very long list. One thing I caution on this particular one is we have to avoid getting too deep into the weeds. We're already 7 pages, and I think we could very well lose the attention span of the counselors. So we need to try to be as direct as possible. So I want to, how I covered the concerns that Houston had about the park impact fees, basically it was in a blurb at the end. This is not the only solution. It talks about impact fees. It talks about stringent building codes. We can get into a lot more detail on those, but I don't know if I want to comment on stuff that wasn't in the draft code, because that's what we're commenting on this.
Right.
Not that we shouldn't.
Right.
And I have some other history on the parks impact, but I don't want to get into it too much, because we have that whole work group that needs to reboot. And I think that's on our work plan still, to get back together with them. It lost momentum right at COVID. We were starting to make some ground. That was some of the proposals that were going to come out. The park board and DEEB had some joint comments that we presented to the board, and then COVID happened, and then the board turned over, and it lost momentum. So we need to probably regroup with them, and the stuff that Houston mentioned was in there. One piece of the impact fee credits for PUDs, though, that I just want to make aware, there's two parts to the impact fee. One is for local neighborhood parks, and one is for the larger parks. Think like, you know, Alderbrook, Vancouver Lake, if you're in that area, not Vancouver Lake in this one.
Regional parks.
So it's kind of like you think of a sewer treatment plant. You have an impact fee for like pump stations, and you have the treatment plant. So you might get a partial credit, but they're probably not going to waive it because there is a nexus to that fee in the development of other regional parks. So, but we did have that in our recommendations, and I think we should maybe put that on our agenda to get back with the Parks Board. The problem is some of these boards are not as active anymore after COVID and after they met remotely, and I'm not sure where the Parks Board is. I don't know how active they are right now, if they have good and strong leadership that will meet with us. So I just don't know.
Let's do some, I'll do some digging on that.
Okay.
Let's wrap this part up though.
I guess just a couple other things that as we were looking through it at AKS was, you know, there's some definitions that are added that aren't in, you know, the proposed definitions or, you know, existing definitions, and some of those are adjusted gross area, equivalent lot area, some of those type of things where they're not well defined, it leaves it open to just interpretation by staff, and, you know, so it's best if everybody's on the same page there. Also, the footnote to, and this is out of 4220.010, low density, the table dash one, footnote two, it says that a maximum of 2 attached single-family dwelling units is permitted outright in R120, R110, 4 attached single-family dwelling units in the other zones. So with that, I guess it could be interpreted kind of two ways, whether it's, you know, a single two-unit building, or is it, you know, as many two-unit buildings, you know, duplexes. You know, it's just, again, kind of a interpretation thing, but just I think it could be clarified. And then the next table, dash two, the density calculation there is also a little bit confusing, I guess, when I read it, and that's where those two definitions come in. But it just wonder if there's a suggestion on how to better.
What was that density calculation definition or calculation section?
It's on page 8 of the 220 at the top of the third.
That's cottage housing on this one. I think that's in their code section that I don't know if I have here.
Oh.
There's two sections. That is the special use standards. And I don't know that I.
This is the urban residential district piece.
Seeing if I have that one. Here it is. Oh, no, they're not.
I don't know why we're
Which one is that?
I got to read this. This is. I don't know who comes up with this, but all right. This is one of the footnotes under Table 4220.010-2 under lot requirements for the urban residential districts, and it is a footnote one. I'm looking for where the footnote, what the footnote is tied to. Oh, residential density, dwelling units per acre, and that's footnote one. Maximum and minimum density for this purpose of calculating densities for planned unit developments, cottage housing, and compact lot developments. Good there. Okay. Density shall be calculated based on the gross area of the site. Densities, so that does not include maximum or minimum density, minus public rights of way, private road easements, or street tracts. For developments that include middle housing, the maximum density shall be calculated on an equivalent lot area basis as follows. The adjusted gross area in acres times the maximum density times the minimum lot area for single family detached dwellings in a zone shall equal the total maximum allowed lot area, which may be divided into any combination of middle housing lots, each meeting the applicable minimum lot size for the housing type proposed. Whoever wrote that needs to come in and explain how the heck you, what is that?
I think that if you use the old definition, it didn't work, and you, and actually overrode all of the previous stuff that was in there. Maybe, and that's, I think, a problem. Maybe it's just, the simple thing is it doesn't apply. Minimum maximum doesn't apply to cottage and narrow.
Well, somehow we're going to have to indicate on our plans how we're meeting density. Adjusted gross area in acres times the maximum density times the minimum lot area for single family detached dwellings in the zone shall equal the total maximum allowed lot area, which may be divided into any combination of middle housing lots, each meeting the minimum applicable minimum lot size for the housing type proposed.
That's
confusing. I hope I never get one of those lots.
Yeah, you're gonna.
And just to be clear, that's okay. Where those two definitions, you know, adjusted gross area and equivalent lot area, I don't know if by having those defined would help to, you know, that we could wrap our heads around that. But
is that only in that, where are those definitions? Equivalent lot
that's
area?
The only location.
In that footnote?
It's a footnote.
Yeah. Okay.
To the lot area.
Wow. In undefined terms.
And then another item, it looks like the density transfer previously referred to, I guess it was single family zone districts, and it's been changed to detached dwellings. So I don't know if that was intentional that it would exclude, you know, duplex, triplex, quadplex.
I wouldn't think so. That should be stricken.
So it was just the way it was changed. It says now that density transfer for single family detached dwellings.
Okay, what's the exact section?
Because attached dwellings were not previously allowed within the lower density zones, so therefore it wasn't an SA. And it was based on a usable lot, a usable...
Hmm.
Yeah, it was based on a usable area. I remember having to go through that, but that should also include attached.
Yeah, so duplexes were previously allowed, I believe, on corner lots there,
yeah.
Which now it says, you know, it's only applicable to detached dwellings.
I think it needs to include attached as well.
Okay, what's that section exactly?
220.010 C5.
Okay. And what we need to do is add detached as well.
Yeah.
Right. Or specific for some of the duplexes.
And
I don't
attached.
Know if triplexes and others were intended. But.
And attached. Okay. Maybe they just take the word detached out
there
and
you
then
go.
It applies to everything.
I like that.
Okay.
I'd rather do that.
That's simple.
So previously it was referred to as single family zone districts.
Yes.
And now they've added it to low-density zone districts for single-family detached dwellings.
That's a good catch.
Good comment, yep.
Yeah, that's a great one. I'm just checking to see what it says now.
And then on, with regard to our comment about the 200-square-foot porch, looking at the gross floor area definition, it refers to exterior walls. So I think technically there the porch wouldn't fit within that, but I don't know what your guys' thoughts are.
It was a structural member. Let's look at that definition again. I thought it was a structural member. Is it interior? Is that what it says, interior walls?
It says exterior.
Exterior?
Walls. Yeah.
I thought it was exterior structural members or something.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. That was that problematic gross floor area, which is a fire code definition that had never was meant to apply to these code sections.
Mm-hmm.
But it got, I can tell you exactly what happened. We borrowed a code from another city, and they used that term, and they had a different definition for it. And we didn't realize we had a definition in our code, and it came, it was a problem.
Yeah.
Unintended.
Another comment was with regard to ADUs and that the fact that they count toward the 200% density, how are those handled if they're done after a plat records?
I don't know if there would be a way to figure that.
It also
seems... Because it only requires... a type one site plan review, right?
Are you talking about a lot coverage, or what are you talking about?
No, I'm talking about density.
Density. Well, the ADUs don't count towards density at all. They shouldn't. What does it say in there? Is it? Is that for a PUD only? Because you don't use the density. Well, I guess you are now in other.
Yeah, they have the minimum usable lot area standard for the density transfers in the low density, and I really think that that needs to include detached, so I think that's good that we removed any reference to that.
The last one I'm still not following those steps. So what was the...
I guess it was a comment from one of the planners in the office, so I don't know the exact code section that he was referring to, but
was
it was more of a question with regard to that ADU's count toward the 200% density. So if a subdivision is done, you know, and utilizes 200%, and then, you know, after the fact, there's a lot that has room for an ADU, could they add one, or is there a way that it's going to be prohibited on the flat?
200% is really for cottage housing anyway. So if you're doing cottages, they're pretty much ADUs.
Yeah, it's only in that one section.
It's only in that one section.
No, it's also in the compact lot.
Yeah, that's what we're talking.
Okay, so.
Cottages too. It's on C2. Okay. Cottages.
So if you do an ADU, it counts.
I don't think there's any discussion around that. The only discussion I can remember was that ADUs would not count towards density, as they don't now.
Yeah, I don't think they do. But if you found somewhere where they do count towards it. I didn't.
I just, it was a note that one of the planners from my office had noted. But.
Okay.
It's on 260.073. It says cottage housing developments may be allowed at up to 200%.
Including any accessory dwelling. Oh.
No, up to two.
It says cottage housing developments may be allowed at up to 200% of the maximum density of the underlying zone, including any accessory dwelling units.
And so that's it, excluding.
Right.
And that's in the cottage code?
Yes.
Okay. Can a cottage house have an ADU?
I would
kind of like the same product.
I don't.
I feel like that's kind of a double dip.
An ADU
dip,
next to an ADU?
I mean, it's basically an ADU already. So I don't know. I think we got to pick our battles.
I think we're getting too far down.
It's a good comment because it probably wasn't unintended, but it's, I don't know if it really applies.
It's in there someplace else, too.
Yeah.
Your comment and the small small lots or something, narrow lots.
It doesn't apply to density in a regular development.
No, it doesn't.
It's only these smaller ones that's
right.
an issue. And they basically, we're basically already building an ADU as a standard unit.
Right.
You can't get four times the density by putting an ADU on each one.
I don't think we want to do that anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So are we landing this plane yet?
Well, I got the definition for gross floor area.
Okay.
So it means the total enclosed area of all floors of a building measured to the outside face of the structural members and exterior walls, including halls, stairways, elevator shafts on each floor level.
Structural members and, right?
In.
In exterior walls.
In exterior walls. Okay. So we could take the patios out then, out of that comment at the end. Where is that? That's under cottages, right?
Sure. I don't know if anybody's going to be doing that. It's interesting that that's in there, though.
Okay, so I'll take the porch thing out.
What else you got, Seth?
Our planners had made a reference to the narrow lot standards, which refer to a wider, like a two-car garage, which has a minimum 16-foot door, which is a 32-foot building if the 50%, you know, front facade is, which leads to a 42-foot wide lot. That's no longer a narrow lot.
It's no longer a narrow lot. You're right.
Okay. Where's that one?
That's it's the design, under. Yeah, the design standards. I think, Eric, you already brought it up, and there was a lot of discussion. I'm surprised that it still made it all the way through because those design standards are too restrictive.
Yeah. What I thought was interesting is the Highway 99 standards, we kind of scrapped that. The idea was to get rid of the design standards in the Highway 9 stat, because no one will do residential in the Highway 99 area because of the design standards. Now, and we actually got rid of a lot of the design standards previously. Mm-hmm. Now they're brought back for the entire county. So we fixed something in the Highway 99 standards years ago, and we brought the same thing back that prevented everyone from building affordable housing or middle housing. And we applied it countywide.
All of us went through and actually did a couple of projects in Highway 99, housing projects in Highway 99. Staff didn't even know how to review it. They didn't know how to interpret it. So that was the best thing that they could have done. And yeah, I would agree that for the counselors that are on the meeting today, design standards are defeating this purpose.
Yep, you have
I can tell you in Highway 99 overlay, those design standards created liability issues because they forced us into having water intrusion possibilities. So we dropped doing any Highway 99 overlay residential stuff. And it just gets the restriction makes it to where I have to be more and more creative to try and create something that's marketable. And I know that Houston's had to do this all over the state, and he could probably speak to it more. We just avoided them.
The design standards have not been generally well received by the public either. We've built alley load product that's attached, detached. We built it in this area of the state. We built it in, you know, the Olympia area. We built it in the Tri-Cities. It doesn't sell as well. It's not as well received. It's not as livable. You know, you got all those aspects to it. And then when you get to the single car, you know, garages, you know, even when we do single cars, we still like to put a wider driveway on them so you can fit two cars or somebody can get out and walk. You know, I alluded this in my notes to Eric, but I'll, you know, speak to it again. It could potentially have some severe ADA impacts as well on accessibility. If you can only put a 10-foot driveway on one of these houses and say you have maybe a handicapped person there or a handicapped visiting, how are they supposed to get out in your driveway in a safe manner if you only have a 1-foot landing strip on each side? You know, with a two-car garage, driveway, you can pull a car out, bring somebody in. In ADA ramps, we've done those a number of times when you have some of these covered porch things and you can only have the door so far back from the front, it really struggles to put a flat entry or an ADA ramp in there. So I think there you can have more adverse consequences to some of this product, and especially for niche builders that may be doing something with retirement or ADAs and product like that.
Leave the design of the product to the builders and the experts, and it should stay out of any regulation by those that don't know the unintended consequences of imposing these design standards.
Mm-hmm. When I was a first-time home buyer, I wouldn't even look at a house if it didn't have a garage big enough to fit my car and my bicycle and my Christmas decorations, right? I wouldn't even look at it. A carport wasn't worth it. A single car, narrow garage wasn't worth it. I struck it from my list as a first-time home buyer. Wouldn't even consider something smaller.
See, you end up with a bigger dining room or family room and a one-car garage.
And not everyone needs a big family room or dining room, right? There were two of us that were buying the house. We didn't need all that extra space. We just needed the garage.
I would say even with a three-car garage, I would say there is a small fraction of people that park three cars in a three-car garage. Usually it's additional storage, it's a shop, it's something along those lines. So the garage is, you know, definitely utilized even in, you know, the neighborhoods we build. You can drive through and you can see all the storage that's above everybody's car if they're parking it in a two-car as well.
Okay, any other kind of final comments?
Yeah.
I'm going to add that ADA thing in the design standards. That was a good comment. So I'll try to put it in. I was trying to avoid making this too long, but I think everything that we've said, yeah, we're going to take a few things out,
yeah.
Not much, and we're adding an equal amount back in. So I think we're still going to be at 7 pages, maybe 8.
I would like to thank you for taking the reins on this and putting this all together. I think this is important work that we're doing. I think that this is important discussion that we had here. I'm glad that we have counselors actively listening in. I'm glad we have the public actively listening in, that they get a better understanding of what it's like for the builders, the designers, to have to deal with these, to have to interpret these. It's best to take care of this stuff now than later on down the road when suddenly interpretation comes into play, especially when it's the most restrictive interpretation. We would hope that staff would work with designers, engineers, the building industry to come up with, if there is an interpretation question, that they would maybe vet that with us before making just a determination based on an internal discussion with staff, that they, you know, engage the stakeholders before making a determination, so that we have a good understanding of the interpretation moving forward, that we can then get out to the general public and kind of memorialize that, and then maybe in future biannuals clarify those items that come up. Again, we're here not only for the counselors, but we're also here for county staff too. They know, they have their expertise, we have our expertise, there is some crossover, but as we move forward with some very significant changes to the code with regards to right now single family, middle housing, and moving on to multifamily housing, that it's all a partnership. We're all trying to achieve the same thing. We've identified things that will help this. There's been a lot of work done by a lot of people in this, and I think that they should all be commended. And I think it's a step in the right direction. We try to point out not necessarily the bad things, but, you know, what we've seen in our collective 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 years of doing this or more, that lean on us, staff too, not only the council. And I think that the experts that have been working on this, and particularly with Dan's help on this also, they understand because they're in the trenches. And they are the boots on the ground as we move forward with this and trying to now design with it and interpret it. But again, it needs to be reiterated. Again, design standards are totally contrary to what we're trying to accomplish here. And
I want to agree with Mike and Eric, and I want to thank this room too because I don't understand this and it's very overwhelming. And so I guess my feedback to the room, so I'm appreciative of that, and feedback to staff is to really help facilitate those discussions so that it's an open dialogue with the county council, because I think that there's some level of, you just kind of have to agree with what's put in front of you when it's a lot and you don't understand and you just are trusting the person that's giving you that information. If I were a counselor, I think I would appreciate the opportunity to ask questions so I can understand what I'm looking at. I don't want to speak on behalf of the counselors, but me personally, knowing that I have access to this room has been incredibly helpful. I text Eric randomly and ask him questions, and it's been a lot. So I guess that's my testimony, giving the council the opportunity to ask the questions, because otherwise, half the time I have no idea what you guys are talking about, to be fair. And then I follow up later and I'm like, okay, what was that? Or I do take really good notes, and then I take them back to the contractors and I say, okay, this is what they said. This is the exact language they used. What does that mean? How does that impact you? And then I'll get more information. So
at this point, we have a hearing tonight, it's a work session. So I guess I'd like some direction from the board, maybe entertain a motion to, I'll make those changes we talked about, and I will circulate it back around before it's finalized, but it sounds like you guys are good with what's been done so far. I'll incorporate the comments from today. Feel free to send some other ones. I'd like to have a draft out before the Planning Commission hearing on, I think, the 15th or whatever that day was.
Are you thinking that you won't be able to get this revised to get something to them today for their work session?
It's at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
No, I can't. Okay. I'm leaving here and going somewhere else.
Okay.
Another meeting.
Fair enough.
However, are you guys okay with our draft, giving that to them today? And can we circulate that to Planning Commission today and make sure we say that this is our draft?
As long as we make sure to also say that we struck that one item, then I'd be okay with that.
I think anything that's been stricken, we should indicate to them that it has been stricken.
Okay.
And that we will provide them an updated final prior to their hearing.
Okay. The problem is someone has to do that. So we struck one minor thing, and that was just the 3-acre. So maybe what we do is we say we struck that one in our work session. We have a few other items. This is our draft. But just so you know that we've done a lot of work to it, here is our current draft, and we'll get you a final one in a week. I can get to it on probably tomorrow or Monday. I'm just not going to be able to do it in the next hour.
Understood. What time is your work session?
5:30. And it's 4 right now, almost. So I'm not even going to be back at my computer. But I think we're giving our draft.
All right.
Can we circulate that? Can we get that? And staff then has to find time to get it to the Planning Commission and make copies of everything.
You know what?
The design standards discussion in there alone, I think, is worth giving
it
to them.
Right.
And then we can even put on our thing what we struck, and they can get a track comments so they can see what we did.
Is it worth just drawing up a one paragraph statement about the design standards and just giving them that section for this with more to follow?
No, I think we're limited by time.
I think we have to give
This has always been the thing with DEEB and Planning Commission work sessions and hearings, is that they always fall like an hour after we get done here, and they always want to know what DEEB has to say.
I tried to put all this stuff together the best I could and get everyone's comments.
Yeah, no, I think you did a commendable job.
I think if we can give them what we have and call it a draft, the code that they're reviewing is a draft.
Right.
Our comments are a draft of the draft.
Right.
So we're going to have still the hearing that we can provide them with our final recommendations.
Right.
And I would entertain, or I want to make it since I did it, but
maybe if someone can make a motion to submit what we have, that draft, to the Planning Commission, and we'll go from there.
Jose, did you have something that you wanted to?
Yeah, I'd have two suggestions for you. The Planning Commission work sessions tonight at 5:30. They're not likely to read this document before that. The hearings in 2 weeks. I don't know that I would necessarily want to receive two different, a draft and then a final. If you can get the draft done by the end of tomorrow, it would seem like that would make the most sense. And I might want to address the memo to actually the Planning Commission instead of the council.
Makes point.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay. Yeah, it would be nice to have somebody there, but I don't think we can speak at the work session anyway.
Yeah.
Correct? There's no testimony taken?
That's correct.
Okay.
Fair enough.
So, all right.
Let's just
get I'll revise it. Okay.
Again, thank you.
No problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
All right. With that, I guess do we have time for any agenda items? Or I know we discussed August code biannual presentation, and then a future on the House bill, Senate bill, but maybe that would be pushed more towards that multifamily code.
I'd like to start that discussion now because I'd be interested. I work for multifamily developers, and I think that's important to know. And not every architect keeps their finger on the pulse of these changes like Ryan's firm does. And so I think it's good that we at least have a basic knowledge of what's going on and how and what effect, if any, it would have to what we do around here. And then, you know, then we can kind of discuss it. And then as the multifamily process gets underway, then we can include that in there as part of it, during the stakeholder meetings on something like that. So does that make sense?
Yeah. So who, I guess, would be the ones to request from staff and others to prepare those?
Megan,
and
if we could get someone, Megan, if you could ask someone from the building department to come in and discuss.
Ryan, do you know
Ryan
specifically?
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, oh, Mac. Awesome. Great. Thanks, Mac.
Yeah, I was going to say, Ryan, if you want to reach out to me offline about any stuff ahead of time, we can make sure we have all of our ducks in a row and get something put together for everybody. So,
awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Let's see. That.
Who's retiring? Megan?
Jim Muir.
Oh, Jim Muir.
Oh, I think that was expected.
My family code amendments?
No, it's not it's the code amendments that Brent will be bringing forward.
But that'll be that August, discussion. Right?
Correct. August.
Oh, August. You'll be waiting. Oh, okay. So we're still looking for July.
Can we maybe get an update on how the new system is working for submitting online?
Oh, LMS or ePlan?
Project mm-hmm. Docs.
Project Docs?
Yep.
That might not be a bad idea. That's good.
I have feedback.
You have feedback? Good. That's why you're here. And I'm sure they would love to hear it. Believe me, I've given my feedback before too. So that's three items. Is that three items we have for next month? So the multifamily, project docs, and
House bills.
The house bills. What else? Wish we had a copy of our work plan here so that we could kind of take a look.
Should we talk about reconvening that park impact?
Oh,
group?
Yeah.
I can dig out our last recommendations.
Yeah, why don't we do that? I know we had a presentation from the parks director, whose name escapes me.
He seemed open to conversations, too.
Rocky Houston. Right. Yeah, I think we can certainly get that going again. I don't know how much traction we're going to get only because they're going to be looking at the comp plan, but it might be a good time to talk about it since they're going to be looking at the comp plan.
Yeah.
I think we need to be really sensitive to staff's time.
I think we need to be really sensitive to staff's time because of the comp plan, and that they're going to be so busy on that that we don't want to become something where we're putting more on their plate than they can handle.
Right.
So, you know, we need to make sure we're reacting to what they need us to do. And, you know, it might be that we have more comp plan items that come up that we need to address.
Right.
So we start the discussion.
Yeah.
And we can look at it and maybe just kind of resurrect what we did. But I don't know that now is the time to go to county staff to have them making additional changes if they're going
right.
to have to be working on the comp plan.
Okay. I would agree.
On
and
that,
housing options.
On that note, does the staff have anything for comp plan that they want us to be talking about?
Yeah. That's a good question.
We usually get an update. Oliver and his staff will usually give us an update on the progress and process of the comp plan update. He usually does that two or three times during the process, I think. So I think that'll be coming up. I don't know how far down the road they've gotten yet that would really be meaningful.
I'm just trying to be cognitive of, we always say that we didn't have enough time or
yeah.
it's coming. And so I don't know if there was a staff person that was, I don't know who's online, but if they just had something off the top of their head they wanted to start thinking about.
That's good. I mean, you brought it up, so it's good that they got them thinking about it.
I mean, the items on our work plan were the population employment projections, comprehensive plan designations, urban growth boundary, capital facilities, and then the climate change and how that'll impact the comp plan.
And I think that's going to be the biggest presentation that they'll be giving us is how that's how they're tying that into the comp plan, because I think that's going to be a brand new section.
Right.
Brand new.
Yeah, another one that's going to take a lot of effort, I don't know where we're going to go on it, but it comes up every comp plan, is the ag land designation. And there's ag lands out there that we're bumping into on the urban growth boundary. And the challenge with those ag lands is when you bump into them, you either have to reclassify and then move the ag lands further out where it's actually economically viable, or you leapfrog over them to expand the boundary. And you extend services, and you have a lot more environmental impacts by extending things. You have sprawl, you have more sprawl, you have, you know, less efficient design. So it's something that we probably need to start looking at. But that's something that we have to do with staff, and actually, I think with the agriculture community, and with the environmental community as well, because sometimes what's happening as we grow, we're going to grow no matter what. And then to house the new people, we have to go over those areas. And now we're putting businesses and housing further away from urban services, and then we have farms in the middle of the city. And some of those farms are growing nothing but hay. Others are productive, and we want to retain them. But the one thing that I think the agriculture community needs to realize, too, is that just because you are zoned different doesn't mean that you can't still keep your farm. Farming is allowed in almost any zone. So you don't have to do it. It gives you options. So as a property owner, your property becomes a lot more valuable. And if you decide that you want to finish your life as farming that property, great, but maybe your kids don't. And you've basically taken their state away by not allowing that to convert and appealing it. So, you know, then that land has no other use. And what ends up, it sits fallow.
Yeah.
It sits there and we leapfrog over it. We build roads across it. And we push development further into what should be ag land. And we're stuck with the stuff in the city. So we need to have that discussion with the environmental community. So maybe we can go in this time on the same side instead of opposed just because of who we are. Maybe we can actually, you know, work on that. Put that as a something on our agenda. I don't know. But it's a big item. You've dealt with it a few times.
Yeah, it's got a lot of moving parts.
Yeah. All right. I've never heard of it, so I'd be interested in hearing more about it.
So is there anyone from staff to present on that too? Or
we would need someone from staff to work on that. And I don't think that's our next meeting, but maybe it's something we could get
later.
The ball rolling and see who needs to come to the table on that item. And if there's really any interest from the council.
I think important too is this just an educational section, or is this something that they want input on, action on, I just don't want them to come in here and go through it without us needing to know, or again, it's that time on staff.
I think it's...
This is the comp plan, though. This is an item in the comp plan. That's why I brought it up.
I see.
It comes up every comp plan, and this is a piece of that comp plan, and looking at where now we put that growth.
Would it make sense, Eric, that for being respectful of staff time, that we as DEEB approach the environmental groups first and start having those discussions so that we come to the table with kind of some suggestions and solutions before we spend too much time?
Maybe it's part of one of the presentations that Oliver's group gives us.
Yeah, because I think there's a huge educational component for both sides. And until we sit at the same table and start having those conversations, I don't know that we're going to fully understand the whole picture.
I think we need to strategize with staff first and then bring the environmental community in. We need to have our ducks in a row and have a well-thought-out plan and proposal.
Okay.
Because if we just start an open discussion, it's not going to go anywhere. I think we need a real reason, a real proposal, and a reason why, and then something to satisfy, like, you know, redesignating areas further out for ag. So the comp plan, we've lost appeals multiple times because of this, and we actually harmed the environment by doing that.
Do we know enough about the environmental side and kind of the pushback that we could confidently build suggestions?
We could look at the previous appeals. I think Jamie, if Jamie's on still, he's got a lot of history on that.
Jamie, you've just been voluntold to put together some stuff for us for a future DEEB meeting regarding ag comp plan stuff. Thank you. All right. I think we've got to have at least a couple of things, and something like that comes up.
Further discussion about
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well then we'll move on to public comment. Is there any public comment here in the room first? Justin, go ahead.
Thanks, Seth. Again, Justin with the Clark County Association of Realtors. Just wanted to make one clarification on DEEB's draft comments regarding the Clark County housing options. It looks like they did fix the gross floor area, at least with ADUs. So I'm not sure about other code sections, but let me just read here. Gross floor area of an ADU means the interior habitable area, including basements and attics, but not including a garage or accessory structure.
But that's the ADU. That's the ADU definition.
Yeah, that's why I clarified. That's just the ADU, because I know in the comments we did address that gross floor area and specifically for ADUs.
Now, so, if we can get it for everything else, that'd be great.
I also wanted to commend Clark County staff for instituting the requirements of House Bill 1337 in regards to ADUs, you know, changing that 800 square feet to 1,000, et cetera. And then I also really wanted to just reiterate some of the comments I heard here today based on design standards. Throughout this process, you know, I've been watching and looking at what the consultants have kind of presented in regards to design standards, and there was real no data backing that 50% facade requirement. Jet Planning referenced the trick or treat test, which seems pretty subjective.
What's that?
And it's can you find the front door? How inviting it is for, you know, a kid trying to trick or treat. So again, I think that's subjective, and we have such a underproduction of housing in the state of Washington that we may not want to go that route. And then just some of the other design standards in regards to ADUs are a little concerning. Detached garages, that ADU over the detached garage, and then the ADU in the front of the primary dwelling unit. And those were in our comments. So I won't belabor any points, but appreciate the work of staff and DEEB as well.
Thanks, Justin.
All right. Well, that is there anyone online who has public comment? I see a raised hand, but can't. Teresa, go ahead.
During the discussion today, recreation has been addressed in several different areas. A little background. Camas and the county all updated their parks plans, which are all now really current And if you look at the parks plans for the cities and the counties, they are all in deficit for their neighborhood and community parks in relationship to the National Park and Recreation Standards across the country. So that's one aspect of recreation when we're looking at that. And especially as we increase density. And so reducing park impact fees when you put in a park within a development may accommodate the people in that development. It may not address the deficit in the surrounding area. And then if you look at combining park and recreation and landscaping in multifamily housing, that affects, at least currently, it's more than one zone. And this goes all the way back to July 5th of 2022, when the interim ordinance came forward, and it was community development that recommended not combining them in looking at past development. There's been a lot of discussion whether for the last 10 years, the last 20 years, we have been combining. There's been no examples of not combining, but there have been some individuals who've done some research on this, and there are examples, and the public came forward and said in a referendum that was gathered by 100 signatures around the county, so that does show public interest in this and public input, that they did not want to see landscaping and recreation combined in multifamily housing, that what the public actually wanted was more data and analysis. There was one case study that was a hypothetical case study with a hypothetical amount of acreage, and the public did not feel that that was adequate in addressing putting more families in multifamily housing and reducing the recreation and landscaping space. So to take the magnitude of this and to put it in the multifamily housing option when the language is being addressed in the tech forum and there is no one from the public on the tech forum, it doesn't seem like a good plan to move forward. It has been proposed in the deed meeting several times that this go to a type 4 process. It went to the planning commission. It was Commissioner Brian Ng who said this should have gone to policy and not have been put in the biannual review. And then when it went back to council, they agreed with that. And if it's under policy, it needs more input. So I think before you move really quickly forward to take this out of a type 4 process where it does get more data and analysis, no one is saying that there's not some other kinds of compromises of how you can't reduce some of maybe the recreation or the landscape, but no analysis has really been done. Nothing has been looked at with the current figures required for recreation, that this go through more of a process. So hopefully you'll take that into consideration, and staff will also. Staff gave a lot of input in this originally when it came forward as an interim ordinance. Most of the work on this was previously done by staff, and I don't see how we cannot have staff and the public involved in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. Councillor Young.
Yes, I just wanted to ask if it's possible that when you do get that document ready that you're going to send for recommendation to the Planning Commission, could you also get that to me as well? It's a very big issue, and I want to be able to spend as much time as possible to work through it.
Will do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else online there who would like to provide public comment? All right, hearing none, our next deed meeting is scheduled for July 6th. And with that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you.